Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, May 9th, 2013. Tonight's main science topic will be, I'll be talking about what makes a comet blue. It's a very interesting and complex topic. And you see the little wannabes jumping up and down, running around the internet, trying to be important, saying, trying to make comments like, isn't Comet Ison a blue comet? Or a picture looks like a blue comet. And so once again, people with no knowledge, no information, first of all, copying things, let's go back about 15 years, when I was dealing with the comet Hale-Bopp on a daily basis, explaining this great comet with my plasma discharge comet model. It was bluish in color, but it wasn't really what you'd call a super blue comet. Up in the night sky, when you saw it, everybody could see it with the naked eye, or a good set of binoculars brought it in a little better, but it was very much naked eye visible. It was not what you would call a blue comet. It wasn't the brilliant blue, although it was bluish, and I made the comment, and this was based on the Hopis, who were talking, some of the Hopi elders were talking about blue comets in their history. So I explained it in terms of the physics of the plasma discharge comet model. The point is that I'm going to talk tonight about blue comets. It's a very complex topic. So 2 points. Some people are now referring to Comet Ison as a blue comet, and then people say, oh, it's the blue Kachina. And that's the Hopi legend. The Kachina, of course, is the Hopi, the dolls, the Hopi dolls represent the Kachinas, and there's many, many types of Kachinas, if you understand what's going on with the Hopi Kachina dolls, for example. They're representations of either deities or important figures, controlling figures in the universe. And the blue Kachina is very specific to a comet that precedes, they say, by about a 10-year period, a red Kachina, which is a much bigger comet. And they do talk about comets. They're very specific. They talk about comets. So it's you know, you would just expect it. The little wannabes running around the internet going, oh, it's a Comet Ison is a blue comet. It's the blue Kachina. Well, there again, you're just dealing with idiots that don't know what they're talking about, have no clue about what they're talking about, and they're copying people who do present correct information like myself. So anyway, tonight's main science topic, I'm going to be talking about blue comets, what makes a comet blue. And there are some comets that are green, like Comet Lemon, much more green than blue or bluish green. What causes that? What's the physics of this? In fact, there are various parts of the comet that look different in color. Why is that? So anyway, I'll be going through all this. It's a, like I said, a complex topic. That's the main science topic for tonight. But first of all, a couple quick announcements. In January of 2013, a magazine called Popular Science had a cover article. It's called China, the Secret Arsenal. And it's meant to create fear and loathing in the United States and the Western world, showing that China is rapidly developing air power, modern air combat aircraft. The drones that they show, look exactly, exactly like the U.S. drones that we see flying around the Mideast, etc. The combat aircraft, the J-20 it is called, is an exact replica of our basically F-16, F-18 series fighter planes that can land on and take off on aircraft carriers. And of course, so let me explain with that small introduction. And of course, the idea is that China is becoming an international power threat that could be in opposition to the United States. And of course, therefore, we have to ramp up our military to meet this oncoming threat. Well, let me explain how the world works very simply for those out there who don't know, and a lot of my good fans already are very familiar with this scenario because this is something I talk about a lot. People say, what does this have to do with science and comets? Well, it has a lot to do with understanding the control of science, who controls science, why do they control science, why is so much effort put into Tier 2 science to put this international facade of top-level science when it is most of it is phony baloney. Well, an equally great amount of money, phony money that is, that has to be loaned to the countries. Now, remember that China is not autonomous or independent. They are very much dependent on banking, etc., and international resource accumulation. And then they do this with the money they make off of selling manufactured goods to the United States. So our balance of trade to China is very negative. So basically, we, through NAFTA, through the ability to take American work offshore, put the jobs over there, have them produce raw materials into products and then send them back here, is funding this, but in the process, China is very much in the world economic system. And so the debt that the United States owes China, then China takes this money, loans it to the United States, and basically funds our national debt while they take some of this money and put into military that then challenges the United States. But very clearly, the models, the airplane, the designs are very clearly modeled after U.S. equipment. This is not Russian. It's not French. It's very much United States. I'm talking about the F-16 converting into what the Chinese call the J-20 or the other, the drone aircraft that mimics 100% the U.S.-developed drone equipment with the ability to either surveillance or send rockets into, say, combat zones where nobody gets killed. If you shoot down a drone, well, we just send 10 more. And eventually you run out of rockets and we get you, is the idea. So drones are this whole idea of drone robotic war is coming into vogue and, of course, pushed by the United States. Development of these so everybody else follows suit, and then this is also pushing behind the scenes the militarization of outer space. The Chinese, of course, developed satellite killer satellite technology to kill the satellites because they know the United States is completely dependent on satellite technology to drive the military, to control, to send messages, to send information. So coming back to the concept that China now is developing a aerial arsenal, and supposedly secret, but if it's so secret, how come they're publishing it in the pages of popular science with all of their models specced out here and come front, side, top, and rear views of all of these aircraft? So the point is, this is how the world works. The banking controllers need to have enemies between countries. I once heard an excellent lecture in which it was explained, and the guy asked the question, he says, how can the banks or the bankers control entire countries? Like the United States has all the firepower, nuclear bombs, aircraft carriers, big ships. How does a banker control that country? Because the country could just turn around, send its military over there and take that banker out. Well, the idea is that the banker knows this, knows it very well. So what he does is he funds other countries equally. And so there's always a balance, a very similar balance back and forth, always going back and forth of military might in various countries. So you have countries like Russia, India, Pakistan, India, China, United States, the European Union is another power. And so these can be moved up and down, back and forth, and against each other. Then you have like the Mideast. Then you have that amazing boogeyman terrorism. Now, the point is that the way you control governments is by, okay, funding somebody over here to cause this other country to react. And so the one thing, for example, when Congress was looking at the budget, the one thing that the sacred cow that none of them would touch was the national debt. It was, they all said unequivocally, publicly, we all must honor the national debt. That's our number one priority. What does that mean? That means not eliminating the debt. That's not doing an international bankruptcy. That means paying off a debt plus all of its interest to bankers that don't have any more money than you or I. And so the way they manage to control these countries is by the balance of military power. Now, they're basically moving American technology for aircraft into China. That gives one more leverage point for the bankers to control the U.S. Now we've got Korea coming online, the Mideast with Iran. The puppet masters, the war masters, as they are called, know this well, and they play this like an old fiddle. So at any rate, the article that's then skillfully placed in Popular Science magazine, that's the last January issue, 2013, very skillfully placed there to draw public opinion away from reality. Who's driving this? It doesn't give you the full picture. So what I'm trying to do on this show is explain how the world is controlled. At the base of this is engineering and science and technology. That's what my show is all about. The control of this is also what my show is about. So you also see in space science, for example, the control of information that's given to the public. The fact that NASA releases, okay, so they released some pretty pictures of Comet Ison a week ago. That does nothing for me. It only supports the fact that NASA is doing research on this comet, Comet Ison, but they dribble out these pictures, and everybody's supposed to get real excited because NASA gave us a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope of Comet Ison. Well, where are the spectrographs? Where's the spectrographic data? Where are the spectrums of these comets in all the different positions and cross sections of the comet? Where are these? Where is the infrared data? Where is the Chandra data from Comet Ison showing the X-rays or the other high energy light that's coming off of this comet? Where's all of this data? See what I mean? NASA dribbles out a picture. We're supposed to bow down to the east because NASA, through its wonderful outreach program, has bequeathed upon us poor ignorant citizens a picture of Comet Ison. And then you have their little puppets running around going, oh, it's the blue kachina. It's the blue kachina, everybody. Blue kachina. You know how stupid this is to hear this going on? And the one thing I'm happy for is that my listening audience is getting an education. Every time you see this, it's an education in itself. What are they putting out? What kind of, you know, little puppet wannabes are jumping around the internet talking? But it gives me good leverage points when I want to talk about science, what's really going on, what's going on behind the scenes. Just a quick note, a final note on the issue with China and the developing aircraft. And by the way, none of these will be online for another 5 years or 4 years. But they're now putting that seed in the mind of the public that, oops, ooh, we better ramp up on our defense spending to meet this. But this is the cycle of war taxation and loans to these governments with interest from the international banking community. And that's what drives the control of the world. Second, of course, is energy. The control of energy, and now coming online, is the control of water. Every day the public is bled to death, paying, you know, now $3.50, it was up to $4 a gallon for gasoline. It will go up during the summer months when people want to drive someplace. It kills every other industry because one industry, the energy industry, which, by the way, should be 35 cents a gallon. There's no reason for $3. We're paying 10 times the amount for gasoline than what we should be paying. Energy in the form of electricity, in the form of nuclear power. None of this is necessary. We should have had Tesla power well organized, and now we have there are technologies that can use wind, not solar. Solar is not a good alternative energy source. It's not dependable. It's very irregular. But wind power, if properly done, and I'm not talking about the three-blade generators that are scattered all over Nebraska and Iowa and Kansas, that is a farce. That is the most inefficient, poor return on investment alternative energy source on the planet. But you're paying for it. You're actually subsidizing this. And so anyway, the entire economy is being sucked down the black hole of infinite energy costs. And that's just the beginning. Now they want to do medical. Okay, well, I'm going to stop talking there. But it's important to understand how the world is managed, manipulated, and controlled. And, of course, as I said, this spills over into science. And so when you understand this, you understand what Tier 2 science does. It does some very important things. It controls the things that the people need on a daily basis, and therefore enslaves people. That's the end. That's the bottom line. Here is an article that just came out. This is from one of the April issues coming out of the American Geophysical Union. I love this development, this amazing discovery by scientists. Now, of course, this is my work from 30 years ago, identifying the longitudinal differential properties of storm systems and the effect that these coming from outer space. So listen to this. Here's an article that just comes out from Chapman Physics Conference held in Ethiopia. By the way, don't make it convenient so other people can go to this. Let's have it in Ethiopia. This is in the longitude and hemispheric dependence of space weather in Ethiopia. This was last November, 2012. But the article starts out, it says, listen to this, and of course, keep in mind my work, where this is where I identified longitudinal properties. That means that as you go north in longitude on Earth or south, and not only on Earth but on the other planets as well, as you move north and south, the weather dependency on structures with the ionosphere, that's that almost invisible charged layer that's up at the edge of outer space in the atmosphere of the Earth, here's what they say. They said, near-Earth space weather is largely due to structure in the atmospheric density and electric currents flowing in the upper atmosphere. And, of course, this is exactly what I've been saying all along. Then it continues. It says, the steep plasma gradients and ionospheric irregularities affect a range of communication and navigation operational systems that depend on radio waves being reflected off or transmitted through the ionosphere. Electrical currents flowing in the upper atmosphere also induce currents in power lines and can burn out transformers. It says, in addition to highlighting the longitudinal dependence, the meeting also explored the impact of lower atmosphere on space weather. This is a relatively new field. Listen to this. This is a relatively new field because there was a previous assumption that all space weather was driven by the sun. Now, talk about a convoluted Tier 2 science concept. And so then I want to read one other sentence here at the very end as they are bringing Ethiopia and the African countries online with this Tier 2 wannabe science, they said, and more important, students were exposed to the field of space science and had opportunities to have one-on-one discussions with international scientists. So what they're doing is these undeveloped countries, as they become scientifically astute, they go there. They have a conference there. They send a bunch of scientists from around the world, and they bring these underdeveloped countries into Tier 2 science. You see what's going on? Giving them basically, but in reading, I don't know if you noticed this, they had the science backwards. They said that the lower atmospheric weather systems drive conditions in the ionosphere, which is backwards. And that's the whole purpose of Tier 2 science, to have backwards science. And these people go, they read articles, they're not intelligent enough to ask real questions. And so, and also, if they ever did, they would be routed out immediately and basically would never receive any funding. So it's the international cycle of NASA through its outreach programs, making it sound like Chapman physics, which is related to there ain't no charge in outer space physics. That's what Chapman physics is all about. And then bringing this to the third world countries, where they then start copying this and regurgitating this in their own science program. So it's a way of emanating Tier 2 science around the world to any developing countries. That's just a very interesting twist on how the Tier 2 science propagates into third world countries before they ever have a chance to get off the ground and start thinking for themselves, and realizing that Tier 2 science is simply that, fairy tale science that couldn't possibly be true. Here's another interesting article. It says, I don't know who does these surveys. It says, the majority of Americans believe global warming is occurring. And first of all, this is fueled, if it's true, it's fueled by the dominant press repeating this over and over and over again. As Lyndon Johnson, our president who took over after Kennedy was killed, and reversed all of the economic policies that Kennedy put into place, especially dealing with money itself. As Lyndon Johnson once said, he says, repeat a lie enough times and everybody will start to believe it's true, and it will become true. That's our famous lying president, Lyndon Johnson, one of the biggest, greatest liars, cheats, con men of all time, who was basically a puppet, a marionette of the banking community. Why do I say that? Because when he took office, they minted one last silver coin. It had the head of John Kennedy on it, 1964. The Kennedy half dollar was the last silver coin ever produced by the United States. From then on, they were made of junk metal, and all of the bills, congressional notes that Kennedy put out were all taken off the market immediately and replaced by Federal Reserve notes, the phony money of the Federal Reserve, or I shouldn't really even call it money, the phony paper pretend money of the Federal Reserve. So at any rate, that was just a little side commentary back to the topic. Majority of Americans believe global warming is occurring. This comes from the energy industry, who wants global warming promoted because they don't have to talk about the real issues, about pollution, about burning oxygen, about nuclear waste, about the damage done by burning immense quantities of coal. The oil industry, which can keep charging enormous prices for a product that's way over 10 times overpriced, which drives the price of everything else up into astronomical numbers. I once talked about the price of hot dogs. The hot dog on the street should cost you a dime, but you pay $2, and that's all additional cost in there that shouldn't be there. But the concept that the majority of Americans believe global warming is occurring is due to the fact that it's just been pounded down the throats of the public. This spring, when we had incredible record, world record snow and cold, the winter lasting well into May, with blizzards throughout Iowa, Nebraska, all the way down to Arizona, blizzards in May, and they're talking about global warming. Let me just finalize the comment on global warming. We have seen overall warming of the Earth. There's no question that the glaciers, the great glaciers, are melting. They're going away. We may have had a little reversal this spring, but that's not going to last long, probably. But what's really going on? Earth is actually getting back to normal. We were thrown into an ice age probably 4,500, 3,500 years ago, the demise of the mastodons, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, the La Brea tar pits in California. This all occurred, the mountain building that occurred at that time, the legends from the Hopi, the Maya, the Chinese, the Tibetans, every nation from around the world, our own Western civilization, historical Old Testament Bible, the Colburn, all talk about these major events. The thing that has been removed from basically knowledge in these countries is that the fact that this was caused by a great comet, actually a number of comets in the solar system at the same time, one of them directly affecting Earth on two occasions. And that's what the Mayans are very clear about, the Quetzalcoatl. So Earth passed through the tail of that comet, also had some major gravitational, plasma, electromagnetic effects. And the Earth was plunged into an ice age. We had glaciation. When that warming starts to occur, when the Earth starts to struggle to get back to normal, the initial warming period is very slow because there's a lot of snow around the Earth. It reflects a lot of light, the great glaciers. It took a long time for them to warm up, but now we're on kind of that exponential warming curve, and we're getting back to normal. Our atmosphere is probably considerably different than it was during the time of the mammoths just a short while ago. There's a period in which the Old Testament talks about the Noah flood, which was thousands of years earlier, before which they never saw rainbows. What does this tell you, folks, Tier 2 scientists sitting out there listening to my show? And I know you are. You sit in your back room and you listen, and you won't tell anybody else you listen, but you are, and then try and copy my material and turn it into Tier 2 ridiculous science by adding your own work. But at any rate, no, the situation is that we are coming out of an ice age and the world is warming up to getting back to normal. And then as it comes up, it tapers off and kind of levels off, so to speak, getting us back to normal. This is all contained in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. And, of course, that published a long time ago, probably almost a decade ago. And just now, as I was reading at the beginning of the show, kind of laughing at modern science, they're just now getting around to trying to talk about electric currents, like they're really up on stuff. They're making these new discoveries, but, of course, they have it all backwards. They're saying that the lower weather systems are driving the conditions in the ionosphere. Completely backward science. But at any rate, another article here. Scientists, especially through global warming and other alarmist elements, one thing Tier 2 science has learned is that by alarmism, that is trying to send alarms to Congress, they can get funding. And so that's been a trend over the last 10 to 15 years, is create an alarm. Okay, the new alarm, they're picking up on the water issues around the globe. They're not solving anything. They're just looking for money so they can do studies, basically sit in their office, twiddle their thumbs, write papers, and get funding. But the alarmist message is that we're heading into water crisis around the world. And it's really true. We have a water crisis, but it's not because we don't have enough fresh water. We have boatloads of fresh water. Right now, the Mississippi River has enough water flowing down it and into the Gulf of Mexico to basically green the entire United States, including the entire United States Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, California. We have enough water, since we had all this snow and then rain this spring, flooding all over Illinois, all over the parts, of other parts of the Midwest. We did last year also, before that big, and 2 years ago, we had major flooding, going back all the way to 2008, and that water simply flows down the Mississippi, ultimately ending up in the Gulf of Mexico. And nobody in our illustrious government, all the way up to Obamacare, who seems to care for his buddies more than he does the country, but all of that water, nobody has the thought that that's good fresh water, perfect for farming. We could be growing more food than you can imagine down in the American Southwest. Arizona could be the green state. But nobody is thinking about taking that water and doing something with it. you know, we got people running this show that have no clue what they're doing. They're doing stuff they shouldn't be doing. They're not doing the stuff they should be doing. And water management is one of it. If you look, I went to the IMAX this past winter, and it starts out, this particular movie that I saw, I think it was about polar bears, or about the Arctic, whatever, and it starts out, they're flying by Antarctica, and it's one of the ice shelves. And the water is just pouring over the side of this ice shelf as it melts in streams and rivers. Every 100 feet, there's like equivalent of the Mississippi River flowing out and into the ocean. At the bottom of every one of those should be a major ship. A ship, possibly even made out of plastic, that's catching that fresh water and taking it up to, say, Africa, up to the American Southwest, to Australia, where there's having severe drought. And that water should be harvested and moved instead of building Chinese warplanes for millions and millions of dollars a pop, or American war industry, which does nothing. It's a giant financial black hole, but for the profit of a few. They should be managing water. We could have an Earth and a population of Earth so amazingly successful that you wouldn't even believe it. More food than you can imagine. Good food, organic food. But no, all that water is just running right down the Mississippi River this year, just like last year, like the year before, and every other year before that. Nobody can imagine taking some of this water, routing it through tubes. We can make big tubes to move oil, but don't move water. Don't move that flood water any place where we can use it. Somebody needs to be completely thrown out of office. Congressmen, presidents, legislators. These people don't know anything. How can you have people running a country that don't know anything? They have no knowledge. They have no ability to do anything different than everything that they've been doing. And it's strictly to drive the profits of a few people. By the way, just a quick economic note. This past week, stock market hit 15,000. Based on what? Where are the jobs? Where's the economy? Ain't nothing happening out here to drive the stock market up to 15,000. So what I see is a balloon, and it's going to blow, baby. It's going to blow, and when it does, you're going to see the financial collapse of the United States very soon. On to the main science topic. I'm going to be talking about blue comets. What's this whole deal about blue comets? Now you got every little marionette, little puppet, wannabe imposter running around the internet, jumping up and down saying blue kachina, blue comet, all of this. What's a blue comet? Well, first of all, every comet that has ever come through the solar system as an element of blue. Like I said, I talked about Hale-Bopp back in the mid-1990s, I talked about Hale-Bopp being the blue Kachina, and there was a good reason for that. That's what the Hopi legends were. They had other indicators that were indicating that the blue Kachina was Hale-Bopp. And Hale-Bopp was, in fact, a bluish comet. But the other thing that the Hopis said is they just didn't talk about one blue comet. They said that the blue comets are the dangerous ones. Now, what did they mean by that? How come blue comets are dangerous? What makes them different than, say, a white comet? Well, okay, so hopefully all of this will come out in the lecture today. I've got quite a bit of time here. So, first of all, what causes a comet to be blue? And let's start out with something. I've been talking in past weeks about the spectrum of a comet. Let's start out with the spectrum of the sun. When we look at the sun, and by the way, don't look at the sun with your eyes or any other optical equipment like binoculars. Oh, my goodness. I have a note here, and this is a fan requested. I'm going to take 1 minute out quickly. How to buy binoculars. What to select. How to look for binoculars that are right for you. This is for astronomical viewing. Okay, that's going to be, I would say, your primary goal. But you're going to have some secondary goals for your binoculars. Are you a bird watcher? Do you like to carry binoculars for travel? When you travel, how much weight can you carry with you? But okay, let's start with an average pair of binoculars. Let's talk about magnification. The first number, like you'll find binoculars, I would say, first of all, go to a reputable sales house. You can go online. Many localities have good astronomical stores in your area. So look for those, support those people, because they're working hard to bring you a great product. Or go online if there's nothing near you. But look for someone who sells astronomical equipment, first of all. You know then they have selected the binoculars that are best for that purpose. A lot of the binoculars say that you'd buy at a department store or something like that may not be what you're looking for. They may be cheap imitations. Here is the issue. With binoculars, you have lenses. You have prism, which is cut glass, polished glass inside the binoculars, and potentially other lenses on the inside of the binoculars. So all of these lenses have to be coated, and not coated with just any kind of coating, but there's very specific coatings that you want for astronomy, for looking at the night sky, at stars, at comets, and other astronomical, nebulae in the sky, to give you the brightest, clearest image. So what happens is first they grind the lens, then they cover it with a clear coating that's very similar in optical properties to the glass that it goes on. Okay, I always tend to talk to people. People want to run out and buy a telescope. Well, that's good if you get up to, say, a 6-inch telescope or larger. But basically, telescopes have a very narrow field of view. Binoculars have a wider field of view. If you have a nice telescope, that's great. But for the average person on the street, binoculars are better. They have a wider field of view. They're easier to handle. You can hold them in your hands. But I want to tell you also is get a tripod. Get a tripod that's very sturdy for the size of binoculars that you have. If you have heavy binoculars, get a tripod that will handle those so that they're nice and stable. That's hands off. It's on the tripod. It makes it much better. Your hands are jiggling around. It's better to have a tripod. A tripod where you can either sit in a chair or stand up and look through them. A lot of times it's much more comfortable to sit in a chair and look through binoculars. But the binoculars give you a nice wide field of view. Look for binoculars that are fully coated. And so that's the first thing, fully coated optics. Second of all, get a pair of binoculars that are comfortable for you. If you're going to travel with them, you don't want them so big and bulky. I travel with a set of binoculars that weigh about 70 pounds. They're huge. They have 100 millimeter lens at the front end, and they're big, and they bring in a lot of light, and they're perfect for comets. A wide field of view, very bright, what you call bright sky. It brings in and almost brightens up the entire sky. Beautiful for comet watching, but those are really big and heavy. I also have smaller pairs depending on the kind of traveling that I'm doing, but all of these with coated optics. And so about a 7 power is very good for astronomical viewing. 10 power gives you a much narrower field of view. And so 7 is a good power. That's the first number on the binoculars. So it'd be 7 by, and then the second number, I would say avoid zoom binoculars. They might be good, but they're a little bit difficult to deal with, but they might be good for some people. They add a bit of complication to the lens, and you might be paying more for the zoom aspect of binoculars than and not such a good quality in the lenses. So for the average person, I would get like 7 by 50. 50, the second number, is the diameter of the big lens. That's the lens that faces away from you. That would be a good set for the average person. 7 power with 50 millimeter lenses. For astronomy, the bigger the objective lens, the one at the far end, the bigger that is, the more light gathering power you have, and the better ability to, let's say, magnify light. That's more light gathering power. And the other thing that's very important is the eyepiece. Look at where you put your eyes. That the lens on that size. You want those to be big. If the binoculars have like a little teeny pinhole to see through, they're going to be extremely uncomfortable. Also, it's good to have eye guards around there. They're like a rubber shield. You can fold them down so they're out of the way, or you can flip them back. They're like a rubber housing around the eyepiece lens, and they kind of come out and touch your eyes or your the area of your face around your eyes, so that kind of blocks the light from obscuring your vision or contributing. And then you need to be in a good dark place. Like a light even in the distance can be very bothersome when you're trying to look at astronomical images. So try and get out away from the city lights. That's very important. So anyway, just a quick review. Get a very sturdy tripod. That's important for the size binoculars you're ordering. Determine the size binoculars. If you're just going to use them in the backyard, get a little bit bigger pair. The binoculars I carry around, I believe, are 25 by 125. That means it's 25 power by 125 centimeters or millimeters on the diameter of the big lenses at the far end. Like I say, they weigh a lot. They weigh a lot, and they're heavy to carry around, but they're beautiful. They give me very good results for what I need. I also have some good telescope equipment that's portable, an 8-inch bead Cassegrain telescope with good digital cameras, etc. But binoculars for the average person, a good telescope base tripod, good sturdy for the size telescopes, and then call up one of the places and have them help you choose this. They're experts and they can help you out also. The first number is the power, 7 to up to 25 is good, but for the average person, 7, I wouldn't go over 10 myself. Unless you are really serious about this, then get the lenses at the far end. You want those to be fairly large so they collect a lot of light. Fully coated optics. That means all the lenses, prisms, etc. in this set of binoculars are fully coated. That gives you the best transmission of light. Back to blue comets. Blue comets. Okay. First of all, every comet that has ever gone through the solar system has an element of blue. Now, why is that? Okay, well, as I've talked about in previous weeks, there are two aspects of the light in a comet. One is reflected light from the sun. And so if you take the spectrum of the sun and look at it, basically you get the rainbow. When we see a rainbow, basically we're seeing all of the colors in the sun. And as I said earlier, before the Noah's flood, they had never seen a rainbow before. And remember the story that was that God destroyed the world by a flood, and as a reminder, put the rainbow in the sky, as a reminder that the flood waters, the rain had ended. They had never seen a rainbow. What does that mean? That means the atmosphere was different prior to the Noah's flood. That was thousands and thousands of years before the Venus event, what I call the Moses event. If you read my two CD or listen to my two CD set, the Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, I talk specifically about that, and of course my shows and other books talk about that also. But the blue comets, why do the Hopi say that blue ones are the dangerous ones when all comets have an element of blue? Well, some light up like a light bulb, a brilliant blue. What does that mean? Well, that means the electrical current that's passing through that comet is extreme. It's much more than the average comet. The light that comes from a comet has two components. One is reflected light, and that typically is the light that we see, the same light that comes to us from the moon. It's white. It's a broad spectrum of light from the infrared up to the ultraviolet, and it appears white. We call it white light. It's all of the colors of the rainbow, literally, in a beam of light. A rainbow is splitting the light into its component frequencies, and it's very clear. It's very continuous. This is due to the fact that in physics terms, the sun is what we call a black body. It's a physics term, and even though it's not black, the term indicates a body that's reflecting emanating heat is emanating from it, heat light. And this comes out in a very continuous spectrum. All of the colors that are in a certain range come out in that light. So the sunlight that reflects off the moon, for example, is white. That's because the moon does not have an atmosphere. It doesn't have chemical properties like, say, Jupiter. We're seeing that the colors that absorb the light from the sun and leaving only the orangish-red light to be reflected, that's what we're seeing in the clouds of Jupiter, that orangish color that comes from sulfur dioxide, primarily sulfur dioxide and other chemicals. Okay, so at any rate, the majority of light that we see from a comet is actually white. That's why most comets appear technically completely white to the unaided eye or the untrained eye. Recently, Comet Lemon, for which, by the way, I have very good data right now. I haven't had time to process it all. In fact, there's so much now that was kind of hidden, but I, thanks to, by the way, a fan who went out, and I won't say how he got this, but he located some sources, and now we have the spectral data from Comet Lemon, which, by the way, very clearly shows Comet Lemon to be a green comet. Why is it green? Because it was lighting up like a light bulb due to the severe amount of electricity passing through this little comet. And I also have now the spectrum of Comet Lemon, the green comet. And the green is coming from carbon-related elements like cyanide. There's the CN, the C2 molecules, other molecules that carbon monoxide that light up green. There are some green bands, illumination bands, luminosity bands, and that's why these comets are looking green. And remember that spaceweather.com tried to pawn off that, oh, this is reflected solar light. Well, sorry, reflected solar white light is white, spaceweather.com. And I jumped all over them on that, and the next day they pulled down their article and changed it and just talked about the light being due to sunlight. Very vague. They just kind of moved away from that, claiming that it was reflected light. But the point is that the sunlight that is reflected from the material in a comet tail, dust, and etc., is white, and that's where the white color comes from. The second component of that comet, the tail material is being drawn into the comet nucleus by electrical forces. The second source of white light is actually from steam, where the water, the H2O is molecule is forming, and it's so hot that it's in the form literally of steam. And so what is steam? Steam are droplets of water that are coagulating in outer space, and that gives the effect of white. When light reflects off of steam, it's white, just like a locomotive. And so that's another reason why comets are white, because of the water that's forming in the comet tail as the hydrogen and the oxygen come in and form those very strong water bonds. And so that's another reason why comets are white. They're reflecting off of that steam in the comet tail. But the other component is the electrical current that's passing through the comet. The plasma discharge comet model says that any of these objects, they're discharging the solar capacitor, that discharge is in the form of basically an electron beam. That's the major charge component in the comet. And so that electron beam, as it initially starts hitting the cometary atmosphere, causes X-rays. That's the source of X-rays to the sunward side of comets. As that electron beam enters the region of the comet, it starts interacting with the nucleus to charge up the nucleus, and then that electron beam continues out the back anti-sunward side of the comet and sometimes can be 100 to 200 million miles long as that electrical discharge passes out into to the far reaches of the solar system. And that's why I say that comets are different in size. If you talk about the physical size of the nucleus, it might be 2 to 5 to 10 kilometers across, or it might be as much as the size of our moon. It could be the size of Jupiter in a huge, huge comet. And that's what I suspect if we ever see a major planet X-type object, of which there are many, there are a lot of them unknown. If we ever see one that big moving through the solar system, we might actually be able to get a glimpse of the nucleus, as like a cover picture of my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book shows very clearly that the ancients had seen the nuclei of big comets. And so at any rate, but that electron beam passing through the comet, the gases of the comet, are causing it to light up literally like a neon light bulb. And instead of neon, you have various other gases. So what is the bluish-green color? Well, there again, we're looking at a various combination of elements depending on the comet. Now, let's go back and talk about Comet Lemon, which was a green comet. The dominant colors in the coma, the gaseous part of the comet, were green. That depends on the chemical makeup of the coma and the comet tail. Now, here's another small little tidbit that I want you to understand. If you take a spectrometer and you're a good astronomer, you don't just take a spectrum of first of all, understand that a spectrometer looks at a slit of light. It's like a long opening, long, very narrow opening. And so you take this long, very narrow opening with your telescope and you focus it on the comet. And so what you're getting is the spectrum of kind of like a line somewhere across the comet coma. And you can position that along the comet tail. You can position that across diagonally across the comet coma. You can position that in various different physical configurations. But basically, that's given you the spectrum of the various parts of the comet. And so here's what happens, and all of that comes back into a spectrometer, and then it fans it out into, breaks it apart into the various colors. And what you get is that broad solar spectrum white, which is continuous. It's kind of like the rainbow, and it very much reflects if you looked at the moon, you would get the same, pretty much the same white spectrum. Sitting on top of that are the spikes of the luminosity curve. Now, this is the, depending on the intensity of these luminosity spikes, and by the way, I'll be posting this for Comet Lemon, in my Comets book, the new ebook Comets, you will find the luminosity curve, or light curve, so to speak, of Comet Hyakutake. I put it in there for a very specific reason, because in 1996, when that was first measured, NASA and all of the other standard astronomical members of the community decided to stop putting out spectroscopic data. That's one of the first things you would do with a star, with a galaxy, with a planet, with looking at anything. You would take the spectrum to see what chemicals are there, what kind of composition, but they stopped releasing them for comets. That's why I'm going through weeks and weeks of training you people to show why NASA, certainly they're taking this data, radio telescopes, X-ray telescopes that are in outer space, infrared telescopes, the Hubble Space Telescope, all of these are taking spectrum of comets. They took a picture of Comet Ison. You're telling me they didn't happen to turn on the spectrometer on the Hubble Space Telescope and just didn't happen to measure the spectrum of Comet Ison? They just released the pictures. Of course they have taken that. They're not releasing it to the public because now you are getting smarter. So the blue and the green color literally is there in every comet. It's just not as prominent in some comets as others. Why is it more prominent in some comets? Because the intense electrical beam passing through the comets, it's much more intense in some comets. So the percentage of blue-green colors, those carbon molecules, the carbon dioxide, the cyanide, the other molecules that are putting out that green and blue color are more prominent. And by the way, the blue color is indicative of ultraviolet. It's the next color before the ultraviolet. So you're getting up into those higher energy light, part of the light spectrum. Anyway, all comets are blue. Some are more blue than others. So the ones that are intensely blue are the ones with much more powerful electrical discharges passing through them. That's why the Hopi said that the blue ones are the dangerous ones. They didn't know about spectroscopy. They didn't have telescopes with spectrometers, but they said, yeah, the historical results indicate that the blue ones are the dangerous ones. Remember that my webpage, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. All of my books are there. You can read about this in detail. The new ebook, Comets, has the spectrum of Comet Hyakutake, and very shortly I will be posting the spectral analysis of Comet Lemon, the green comet that's been up in the sky, and I'll be talking more about Comet Ison. I am out of time. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.